Today's conversation is with Angus O'Gorman. Angus is Head of Delegated and Specialist Solutions at Willis Towers Watson here in Australia. He has over 20 years' experience in investment management, having started out with Europe's largest CTA hedge fund in the mid-90s, and then he came to Australia as Head of Implemented Solutions at QIC, where he was responsible for QIC's multi-manager portfolio. This is where I first met Angus. I was running my own hedge fund and kept pestering him to try to get him to allocate to my fund. He always said no, unfortunately, but as the true professional that he is, did it in a gentle and polite manner. God bless him. In this conversation, we discuss some of the risks and opportunities of passive versus active investment strategies and where some of the opportunities exist in a low interest rate world. We also talk about some of the challenges with hedge fund investing. Angus is such a deep thinker around investing. Just when I'm expecting a certain answer, he brings so much more depth and breadth of perspective, which is so refreshing in a world where everything is a meme. He's exactly the type of person you would want as a fiduciary, and I'm so grateful that he was able to come on the podcast. I hope you enjoy. This is David Hobart from Beyond the Obvious, the podcast in search of unexpected insights for investment professionals. So Angus, thank you so much for making the time today, coming on the podcast. It's really great to you know, pin you down, and you're a busy guy. So it's awesome to get your insights.
No problem, Dave.
So really interesting time in markets, Angus. I mean, you're obviously across markets all day, and you're across your clients' interests all day. I know you've got some perspective around index investing or passive investing versus active investing. And, you know, I wonder, you know, given what we've seen in the last couple of weeks with the big sell-off in global equity markets, whether or not that active versus passive conversation is going to get highlighted over the coming weeks and months again.
Yeah, sure, Dave. As you say, a pretty interesting time, all right. I suppose by and large, maybe I should start off and just say I'm delighted to be here, and it's a pleasure to come on and have a chat with you. Obviously, we've known each other a long time, Dave, so always happy to catch up and talk about things. And I suppose, yeah, more specifically, that I suppose any of the comments I make today, they're very much kind of my comments rather than the firm I work for. But as you say, yes, very interesting time in markets, significant falls in equity markets particularly. And it does, I suppose from my perspective, given my history and even the role I have now, it does highlight the logic perhaps behind, or certainly the debate between investing in a relatively passive way with a lot of exposure to kind of equity markets versus a kind of more diversified dynamic or active approach. And obviously we've had about 10 years of kind of equity markets and bond markets doing very, very well. And we really haven't had or seen many episodes such as this over that period. So it is a reminder that there is some risk out there, which is, I think, actually a good thing.
Yeah, so Angus, maybe it's worth taking a step back and kind of looking at the landscape over the last 10 years. And I mean, I'm not sure what the percentages are of market participants now engaging in passive strategies like ETFs or index funds versus active management. But I certainly know that there's been a move toward passive over the last 10 years. Is that driven largely by just a bull market or central bank policy, or what do you think's behind that move?
Yeah, it's a good question. Certainly a significant move in that regard. Look, I think maybe there's a few different things. I suppose first off, there's minimal effort required to invest in an index or to invest passively. So for investors with pretty limited resources, it's an easy path. It's become very cost effective. It's also become institutionally acceptable. So, you know, if index investing or if you get periods like this where markets fall significantly, then maybe there's a little bit of comfort in that collective failure. So maybe there's some of the reasons. Of course, indices are diversified as well. You're not investing in a single stock. So, yeah, you know, the ability to capture exposure to a broad range of markets and reduce that idiosyncratic risk is obviously maybe perhaps one of the kind of original drivers behind wanting to invest in well, call it equities and then a portfolio of equities and then moving down to an index-based approach.
Yeah. So you mentioned there's a cost incentive to invest in an index kind of way. Within the superannuation industry in Australia, is, as you say, it's been more institutionally acceptable to do that. Are there risks associated with that in your view, like to more concentration of assets? Well, yes, in diversified assets, i.e. through index investing, but you know, what are the risks of that, do you think?
Yeah, look, I think it's probably... maybe it's a little bit broader than just index investing. I suppose a lot of superannuation funds have kind of large exposures to equities. It is more cost effective to do that on a passive basis through index investing. It may be done on an active basis, depending on the superannuation fund. I suppose the largest risk with that is that the performance of the last 10 years has a on an institutional impact or indeed an impact on the regulatory environment. And maybe to a degree we've seen that and we are seeing that. I think there's some, we've done some analysis at Willis Towers Watson, you know, just looking at kind of performance versus, I suppose, performance of an equity and bond index-based portfolio over kind of long periods of time. And the last 10 years, performance has been stellar, well above what you would expect from a kind of passive exposure to those kind of two major asset classes. And, you know, if you kind of go back 10 years and you think about where we were 10 years ago, kind of in the middle of, kind of starting to understand the financial crisis and its implications, a push away from alternatives, a regulatory focus on cost and superannuation, kind of halfway between the choice regime and the my super regime, all of which was about, as I said, kind of cost and bringing costs down. And by its nature, that's led a lot of superannuation funds toward low-cost, liquid, simple strategy.
So what I'm getting is that there's a fresh set of expectations being caked into future performance. And not only is it getting caked into the minds of the end investor, i.e. the member of the superannuation fund, but it's getting caked into the minds of regulators that are legislating, you know, to make it easier to, well, to make it harder to be outside of a very small range of returns.
I think that's fair. I think the issue is that low cost generally equals high allocation to equities, perhaps with an allocation to bonds. The problem with that is whether or not that allocation can actually deliver on the kind of return objectives of members. And whilst it has over the last 10 years, there's no guarantee it will in the next 10 years. And I suppose part of the challenge is some of the very large super funds in Australia have taken on that approach. And by taking a kind of on that approach, it is baking in the expectation that low cost can still deliver strong returns. It doesn't allow for the idea that actually portfolios that are well managed, that are active and diversified, which ultimately cost a little bit more, are generally a better way to invest both in the short term and the long term. So the risk is that we kind of, it's a race to the bottom in terms of fees, and what we end up with is a very index-based approach to superannuation.
Yeah, and I get that there's risk to that in today's markets, given that interest rates over the last 10 years through the post-GFC have driven to zero and in many cases below zero. So bond yields are zero or close to all the long-duration assets are, you know, you could argue are all expensive courtesy of central bank policy. And if you look at a typical, you know, 60-40 balanced portfolio of bonds and equities, or equities and bonds, there's downside risk in price, particularly in a passive investment environment. So, Angus, you talk about a more active management approach. How might that look versus the current sort of passive focus on passives? How does a more active approach look in terms of your investment options?
Yeah, good question. I think, you know, probably most important thing to remember is you start with objectives when you're trying to figure out an investment strategy. And if you have a very long investment horizon, then there's no reason whatsoever not to own a lot of the kind of highest expected return, highest risk type of investment. So that kind of leads you generally toward holding equities. Now, of course, the next question is, should you hold them passively or actively? And the purpose of active management is obviously to deliver a higher return. I would make the point that active management, for me, another way to think about that is just it's research, right? So you can either you can either invest in something that is, you know, as I talked about, institutionally acceptable, i.e. the passive approach perhaps, or you can decide to do some research and put some time and effort into building a portfolio or pay somebody else to do that, i.e. Hire active managers. So, yeah, like you can have a big debate about active versus passive, but ultimately for me, another way of framing that is research versus no research. And by and large, I suppose in life, most of us know that if you put time and effort into something, you generally get a better outcome. And so just kind of dealing with the whole active passive side of things at the right price, putting time and effort and research into something should lead to a better outcome. But that's all kind of fine if you have a long investment horizon, a fairly concentrated or equity heavy portfolio makes a lot of sense. If you have a shorter investment horizon that you're worried about performance year to year, or indeed if you're in drawdown, so which is typically in retirement for individuals, then you need to think much more carefully about how you construct a portfolio. And the reason for that is because when you're in a drawdown phase, volatility can lead to poorer returns relative to somebody who's actually investing, cash flow positive, where volatility is generally actually works in your favor. So, as I said, it really does depend on your objectives, how you should construct a portfolio. But if we're going to compare a kind of equity heavy, or as you said, the kind of 60-40 kind of portfolio to something that's a bit more diversified, then I suppose there's a range of tools to manage the downside of things. And that's mostly what you're trying to do when you do kind of approach things kind of going beyond those two asset classes. So what are some of the ideas, or how do we kind of think about that? How would we go about doing that? How would I go about doing that? I suppose, first off, you know, what we're essentially trying to do is achieve a similar return outcome over time to a 60-40 or a 70-30 index-based approach. So what you're really looking to do is own things other than equities and bonds. And whilst, of course, you still own those things, you're looking for, I suppose, diversification on one side of things. So maybe you can kind of think about kind of two separate sides to this. So one side is, how do I bring as many things in as possible that will deliver me a better return? And then maybe the other side of it is, okay, given that better return and the risk I'm willing to take on that side, what are the ideas I can kind of invest in that will hopefully kind of manage through periods like last month or two, where maybe if I am worried about the next year, then I've something in place. Because ultimately, it's a balance. You need to take risk over time to deliver return, no matter, you know, who you are as an investor. But how do I manage in the short term? So for me, I suppose, kind of looking on the equity side of things, owning less equities means owning other things that can make money, or being more active. So, for example, alternative credit, we think is a very good opportunity set that's really based around finding decent areas, decent opportunities
to lend to either consumers, corporates, or indeed governments. And in that area, it's interesting because super funds have little or no exposure really to truly risky credit, maybe small little allocations here and there, but nothing really significant. So there's a lot going on in that area. Credit markets are actually enormous. Private credit markets in particular are significantly larger than the public equivalents and or listed traded equivalents. And so, yes.
And do you tend to think of credit, the alternative credit in that sort of equity bucket, as given its risk and volatility profile versus in the bonds or fixed income bucket?
Yeah, for sure. Because at the end of the day, credit does have a relationship to what's happening in the economy, and just like equities do. So, you know, if you're going to lend to on a relatively risky basis, then you've got to assume it's got some kind of relationship to equities. Now, it's not an exact relationship, which is why it's a value, and it's got some interesting characteristics to it that make it different from equities, i.e. that it's, well, I suppose, less volatile. The return you earn from it, certainly the income you earn from it, is much more known in advance. Clearly, there is a kind of downside when things go wrong, and that's probably quite an interesting observation that by and large with credit, people worry a lot about over diversification, but credit's one of those interesting areas where, assuming you are getting the income stream or the yield you want and that you've done your credit risk, i.e. that you've hired high quality investment managers in our case, then what you really want is to manage the downside, i.e. Reduce the left tail, because ultimately if you lend to somebody, the thing that can really go wrong is they don't pay you back. So you're a bank, you lend to an awful lot of people, lend cleverly and bring that into your portfolio alongside equities. We think that's a great tool. And yes, you can worry about time and cycle and all that kind of stuff, but at the end of the day, you can worry about that in equities as well. Why not own both rather than own just one?
Sure. So this is a slight aside, but personally, I'm having trouble framing the investment environment currently because of the compression in rates everywhere. It's very hard to see where there's value in many markets at all. How has the policy stance of central banks around the world over the last, let's call it 10 years, how are you placed today in terms of framing that in the context of another 10 or 15 year time horizon on investing? Big, broad question, but... Yeah,
good question. It's a good question. And you kind of talked about it earlier. You talked about the fact that we've had 10 years of a very sharp and unexpected decline in real interest rates. And that is the fundamental reason why equities and bonds and any other asset that's got duration in it has done really well. And relative to expectations 10 years ago, those things have surprised on the upside. That's obviously why a diversified portfolio is a good idea, because you don't actually know in advance. No one can predict how things are going to work out. So I suppose, like, just kind of back to the super fund somewhat, you look at performance for the last 10 years, which has been fantastic, but it certainly wasn't in people's models 10 years ago, or expectations that this is how things would play out or work out. So... in the same way that 10 years ago, nobody truly knew what was going to go on, we don't really know how that's going to play out going forward. And so, again, you've kind of got to step back and say, I need to take risk over time. As if I'm a long-term investor, I need to kind of generate a return. How am I going to do that? But at the same time, I am worried about where real interest rates are. I am worried about where risk premiums are in general, whether it's equity markets or anywhere else. So I've got to work my assets harder. I've got to think more cleverly about things. And so it's probably a lot of things you do kind of at the margin that should help you through this kind of period. So, yeah, as you say, we talked earlier about the idea of being able to predict markets we were talking about it before we hopped on. I don't see any ability to do that. So you've got to go to the areas where you kind of can have some control or some sense of certainty. So, for example, driving down unrewarded costs. We talked about super funds reducing fees, so reducing, being very focused on and the regulator indeed being focused on cost. Cost with an expected net return is a good thing. Clearly, cost with no return is a bad thing. So if you can drive, if for the same level of active management, for example, if you can drive down active management fees, then you're going to get a better net outcome. So there's kind of one thing. I think you know, we didn't talk too much. I didn't talk yet too much about kind of real assets. I think, you know, that again, infrastructure and property prices and returns very much have benefited from the environment for the last 10 years, falling real interest rates and the impact that that's had on those cash flows. So, and indeed, just the wave of institutional money that's gone after, particularly kind of very large infrastructure investments. So I think for that one, again, it's about being clever. You've just got to work a bit harder. You got to look around the world. You certainly shouldn't be just looking in Australia. You probably need to step down in terms of size, which means that maybe if you're a mega fund, you're probably maybe not best placed at the moment to be looking at kind of mega deals in real assets. You've got to ultimately look at where capital is scarce and find ways to deploy it there. And I suppose, you know, 10 years ago and over the last 10 years, there were many more opportunities to do that. So ultimately, I guess I'm saying you do actually have to do research and you do have to work harder and you should build a more diverse portfolio, because we can't predict the future. And because, as you point out, we're certainly at a point where real interest rates have come a long way. And whilst, again, I'm not saying they are going to continue going in one direction, as you point out, it wouldn't take much of a bounce to really negatively impact portfolios.
Yeah, sure. So what about hedge fund strategies, Angus? Like, I know a lot of hedge funds have struggled in this low rate environment to compete with basically, you know, long-only passive equity managers.
Yeah, there's probably a few things. Both our backgrounds are in hedge funds, so certainly close to my heart and yours. There's a few funny things, I suppose, about hedge funds. So first off, you know, everyone talks about hedge funds being absolute return. Well, a bigger part of absolute return is the cash rate, right? So you start every year with no position. If you're truly active, or in a sense, you could start every year in that way and you've got to deliver a return. But what you do have is $100 of capital, and that capital, at the very least, if you're taking no risk, should be earning you cash. Pretty much every asset in a superannuation fund's portfolio or any investor's long-term investor's portfolio has benefited from a fall in real cash rates, apart from cash. And so, you know, people talk about alternatives and they kind of bucket things together like real assets and hedge funds. And the problem with that is the real assets, the value of real assets has risen as real cash rates have fallen. But the expected return, total return or absolute return of a hedge fund is basically coming down because cash rates coming down and there's no compensation for that, because hedge funds don't have any duration in them. Certainly if they, you know, when they're sitting in a passive or kind of risk-free position. So probably the first thing to say is it's somewhat logical that hedge funds would underperform in the last 10 years on a relative basis. But that's not the whole story, because there's a few other elements to it as well. First off, the very large hedge funds around the world have earned and do earn very high base fees. And, you know, I suppose when I started in hedge funds, which would be back in 95, a large fund, in fact, the largest hedge fund in Europe, the largest CTA at least, the area I focused on, was $250 million and it earned about 1.5 in 20. And back in 95, that was a decent fee. It certainly kept the lights on, but it didn't make people rich. Whereas today, you have 5, 10, 15, $20 billion funds that are sitting on still kind of earning fees in the region of 1 or 2%. Now, that's not really an incentive to actually take any risk at all. And equally, even startups, like investors being willing to plow kind of $1 billion into a fund that's earning that still wants to kind of earn a management fee of 1 or 2%. Even in that situation, you're kind of you'd have to ask yourself the question: are you really aligning interests in doing that? Mm-hmm. So large funds in general. We would kind of say and have analyzed and noted that kind of if you look over the last 25 odd years, the level of risk taking has kind of continuously fallen because ultimately, yeah, I think they're making too much money. They're incentivized to do very little. So that's kind of part two of the problem. Yeah. Part three of the problem is you certainly had an environment where the kind of levels of central bank activity, the levels of liquidity in markets has meant that there's really has been a kind of dampening of volatility. Now, that the challenge here is that we all know that that kind of daily volatility is somewhat meaningless anyway. So dampening it, on the one hand, you could say that's just making markets more efficient. But on the other hand, it's been somewhat artificial dampening of volatility. And the impact of that is your ability to kind of have very large and significant moves away from, well, whether they be trends or moves away from fundamentals has been reduced. So I think collectively, you can understand why a typical hedge fund might have struggled in this environment. Now, I'm not talking about hedge funds that own equities and credit because they should have done really well. I'm talking about hedge funds that are there to truly take kind of active risk in a
sure.
constrained way. So I think you look at all them, those reasons, you say, okay, I can kind of understand where things are, but you can't continue to just allocate to that situation, even if we get a recovery in volatility and we see kind of liquidity, less kind of central bank activity, there are still some fundamental issues that need to be resolved.
No, that makes sense. I mean, certainly the underlying incentives inside some of those big businesses, as you say, doesn't seem like it's necessarily aligned with the end users, the investors. Angus, we're just about out of time. You know, really.
Hey, I was only getting going.
Oh, you were, and it was good. It was really good. I was going to just ask you, if there was anything that you'd really like get from this. You know, is there any angle, not angle, but any parting thoughts?
Yeah. Maybe the message is that the last 10 years have made investing look easy. And whilst there's plenty of things you shouldn't do and you shouldn't invest in things you don't truly understand, equally, you do need to realize that there's a lot of risk to investing. And just because we haven't seen it for the last 10 years doesn't mean that you shouldn't put effort into it or said better. You do need to put time, resource and thought into managing portfolios and managing investments. And the last 10 years, I think, has made a lot of people complacent.
No, and that makes sense. And particularly in light of the last month, I think, that's a pretty timely message. You know, now's the time to sit up and pay attention and do the work, basically. And if you're not up for it, like get someone who knows the business intimately to do the work. But it's not all about being passive. Angus, thanks so much for taking the time today. It's been really great to have a chat. So where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
I suppose if you don't have close contact with me, you can find me on LinkedIn. Very happy to get messages through LinkedIn.
I work at Willis Terrace Watson, as Dave would have noted at the start. So equally, I'm sure you'll find me through that mechanism as well.
Super. Great. All right. Well, thanks, Angus. And, keep the helmet on.
Thanks, Dave. My diversified helmet.
Diversified helmet. That's great. That's it for today's episode of Beyond the Obvious. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a favourable rating or review in the App Store. If you'd like to get in touch, please reach out to me on LinkedIn. Until next time, hooray.